All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuckocrats? What the fuck publicans? How's it going? I'm Mark Maron. This is my show. This is my podcast. This is WTF, the podcast. Founded in 2009. Is that right? Yeah. God, man, we've been doing this a long time. Wait, how are you? Today on the show, someone I've known a long time, kind of. Have I really? Well, I knew her way back when for a short period of time, maybe a little bit. Maybe I met her a couple of times like 20 some odd years ago. How's that? So maybe saying that I know her a long time is not exactly right, but I met her and she was familiar to me. And then after I talked to her, even more familiar to me because we're very similar. It's one of those conversations where it's like, wow, this is getting deep here in terms of issues. But Ariel Levy, she's got her book coming out in paperback, An Abbreviated Life, a memoir. It's available now, and it's kind of an intense talk. I guess this is sort of intense talk time. I got a lot of feedback for the Phil Elverum, Mark Mulcahy conversations. Most of the feedback was, I'm crying at my desk, but it's good. It's always good when crying is good. You know, those are the big moments in life. When crying is good, it's good. When crying is bad, maybe you should get out of that situation. What do you think? Oh, and also on the show, I'm not sure I should have done this, but look, I'm a fan of country music, and I have an open mind, and you know, I can respect artists, but this is one of those things where it's like, what are people going to think of this guy? I have his first record. He's got a new record coming out. But, you know, he wanted to come by. He came by. So I was going to, I'll indulge him. Wheeler Walker Jr. So that's coming up. You should look forward to it. So I hope you're keeping it together and you're fighting the good fight still. It is a country worth fighting for, even when it seems daunting and full of fucking idiots. And scary as the sort of foundations of reality kind of shift and move and become unclear. Just know who you are. All right. You just got to know who you are. When you come back, you got to know who you are. That was like an old rule of hallucinogenics. You know what I mean? Just hang on. Remember your name. Just remember your name and where you're standing and what you are and what you stand for. Right. Right. That's it. How about I just fucking relax? Can I just fucking do that? Would that be all right with you people? Can I just fucking relax for a couple weeks? I don't know if I can. I hadn't done stand-up in a couple weeks, maybe a week or so. But I spent all that time doing the big sets on the road, and I come back, and a couple weeks go by, and I'm like, nah, I don't think I want to do it anymore. And then I think, well, what the fuck, what does that even mean, man? What are you going to do? It's like, I don't know. Does anyone really care? I mean, what's the point? You know, it's like, I don't know what I want to say, And then I go a little deeper in it because I'm thinking, where does that come from? Because I'm kind of causing myself stress, and I put in for a spot at the Comedy Store on Saturday night, and I felt like I hadn't done the store. I haven't been there in months. That's a very specific place. I know I'm going to do the spot on Saturday, and I'm kind of like, what am I going to, how come I just, Jesus, I don't know what I'm going to say anymore. I mean, what's the point? You know, I just, it's like, haven't I done enough? Can I just take a break? And heading into a Saturday night spot in the main room, I was trying to figure out what the fuck is the struggle here? Like, how does that happen that I've been doing something more than half my life? And sometimes I'm just sort of like, I don't know how to do it. I'm like, I don't have any new jokes. Why would I have new jokes? I've been on the road for, you know, months doing this hour, hour and a half, hour 40, whatever the hell I was doing. So those jokes, no, most people don't know those jokes. Because I don't have a new fucking joke or two, or a new bit or a new idea, which happens a lot in these very monologues, arguably this could be one of them. I just kind of undermine myself completely. And I'm like, well, fuck it. Where are the new jokes going to come from? When does that happen? When does the muse deliver them? But I went to the store and then I just got it in my head. I'm like, dude, just go up and fucking kill. Just go up and kill. You know, do the, yeah, it's a full house. You know, do the jokes you like. Stay present. Do the ones that, if keep it current, you know, take some shots, but do the good ones. It's 15 minutes. Just go up, take your place. You haven't been to the store in a couple weeks and fucking kill. So I go back, I go up to the, you know, I get there, I hang out. They put new bathrooms in the back hallway. Now, that may not be a big deal to some of you, but to those of us that have been going to the Comedy Store for half our life, any little structural improvement is sort of like, wow, man, things are really turning around. There's a couple of clean bathrooms in the back hallway. Not the single occupancy ones that smell funny and you never know what you're going to be looking at when you walk in there. I know this is probably the people that like to do blow in fucking bathrooms, this is going to, you know, they're taking a hit on this one. But people who enjoy having, you know, the option to go to the bathroom with a couple of stalls and it's clean, you know, welcome to the new Comedy Store. And then I just got on stage and fucking killed. And I don't always do that, because it's not always what I'm thinking about. Sometimes I'm just thinking about, I hope this works. But I'm like, dude, just go up and do the fucking job and kill. Just pick it out. Just pick out the shit and do it. So in other words, I'm probably going to be doing comedy for a while longer. Because it felt fucking great. You hear me? Yeah, so I feed my cat fish. Look, I go to the fish store, I get fish for myself so I don't clog my heart up with other garbage animal products. And, you know, there's some fresh fish that is cheaper than cat food, to be honest with you. I don't know if you have a fresh fish place, but, like, I get some, like, I don't remember, rockfish. It's like $8 a pound. And I just get, like, a quarter pound, and I just give them little treats of fish. So they feel wild. So they feel like they've done something with their day. You give a cat some chicken or some fish. I'll get some Trader Joe's chicken breasts just for the cats. Yeah, I'm living large. That's how I'm spending my money, feeding my cats like wild animals. I'll tell you though, man, you give a cat some raw fish and they are flying around the house like they've just achieved something amazing. They were in the water killing fish in their mind. Just that little taste of the fresh fish and just trigger something in their little wild animal heads. And they just fly around the house, proud and wild. Man, it's that easy. It's that easy. Don't you wish it was that easy? When was the last time you felt proud and wild, huh? When was it? So, all right. So Wheeler Walker Jr. came by. I don't really know why I had him over. It was probably a mistake. But he's here. And he's a character, so I'm going to go ahead and share with you my little chat with Wheeler Walker Jr. His new album, Old Wheeler, is available now at WheelerWalkerJr.com. That's JR, not Junior. So WheelerWalkerJR.com or wherever you get music. So listen to me and Wheeler.
Every now and then, there's a decision that's a no-brainer, and I can tell you from experience, it was a no-brainer to use Stamps.com when we started using it 11 years ago. Crazy. 11 years ago.
Now, more than a decade later, Stamps.com is better than ever. The Stamps.com mobile app is like having a post office in your pocket wherever you are. You can take care of things on the go, like mailing checks, sending invoices, legal documents, and more. Easily schedule package pickups through your Stamps.com dashboard. And when you need to take care of shipping, all you need is a computer and printer. Stamps.com even sends you a free scale. Make the same no-brainer decision that over 1 million other businesses have with Stamps.com. Sign up with the promo code WTF for a special offer that includes a 4-week trial plus free postage and a free digital scale. No long-term commitments or contracts. Just go to Stamps.com, click on the microphone at the top of the page, and enter code WTF.
We're talk.
So, Wheeler, what is it with you guys? You can't take the hat off to wear the headphones? I mean,
No, man. I gotta look. I gotta keep, you know.
Yeah, but no one's looking. Well,
we got David over here.
All right. Are you hiding something?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm losing my hair, but
you are.
I always said that. The difference between a guy who goes into rock and roll and the country guys, I think, are. The country guys are the guys losing their hair so they can wear the cowboy hat.
Well, I mean, I always thought when I was younger, growing up, that the cowboy hat would cause baldness somehow. That you're not getting enough sun or putting too much pressure on your head. I don't know.
I guess it's a catch-22, I suppose.
Yeah, let me see the record. You know, I liked the first album. You know, I got behind it.
Yeah, man, you were a lot of help with...
Did some tweeting.
Did a lot of tweeting. You also tweet about a lot of, you know, other great country artists there, too.
Sure, sure.
Remember you liked this girl Aubrey Sellers' record? Remember
Aubrey
that?
Sellers.
She was good, and Margot came
Margot came in here. Sturgill came in here.
Isbell, yeah. Right? He's been in here.
Isbell's, yeah, years ago I talked to Isbell. So you see yourself, those are your peers.
Well, to me, I don't think they'd say that, but, you know, to me they are.
Well, did you sell any records on that?
Yeah, I did real, I mean... The goal with the first record was to sell enough to make a second record, and you've got it in your hand. So yeah, it was.
Did you make any profit at all?
More than I thought. Yeah, I mean, we had. It's weird in the in independent music. It's like, what's a profit? It's like enough to keep to
sure
to do the next one.
But I still wonder, these songs. How are you going to get radio play? On some of these songs, or it doesn't matter anymore.
It don't matter. We actually put out they have those trade magazines where you put out the, like, how many stations added you. We actually put out a fake one in the trades.
Yeah.
Because we sent one of the songs out to radio.
Yeah.
And it got zero ads. And they actually printed zero ads.
Yeah.
Like zero stations added it. So we actually bought an ad in the paper,
Put zero?
Congratulations to Wheeler Walker Jr. for zero ads.
Let's just talk about some of these on this, the new record, Old Wheeler. Do you want me to read these song names?
Yeah.
Pussy King. I mean, I understand it, but I mean, like, how do you...
It's like, Elvis was the king, Michael Jackson was the king of pop. There's nothing else left.
So you're the Pussy King.
Yeah.
And Finger Up My Butt. What's that one about? How's that going to get rated?
Well, we're kind of struggling with getting that on the radio, but it was a...
You're struggling with getting Finger Up My Butt on the radio?
Yeah, well, I'd heard a story, there's a big-time country star that I'd heard stories of who he can only really get off when he has a finger up his ass, so...
So it's not even about you? It's about some other guy?
Correct, but I can't say his name. I'll get in trouble.
But it doesn't matter, I'm not going to play it anyway. Now, Drunk Sluts, that should be popular.
Yeah, that's. I think that could be the hit.
The single?
Yeah.
But I mean, what happened? I mean, it's because I've heard the album, the other album, and, it's not novelty music. I mean, it's real country music with the real country sentiment, and it's honest. But it seems like you're almost making it more difficult for yourself to get radio play by making it.
Yeah, well,
filthy.
I mean, that's why I'm here. You know, it's like, I can say fuck here, It's like, fuck it, I'll just do the podcast and I'll do it my way and I don't want to censor myself, it's like,
okay, I get that, but I mean there's ways to capture the same sentiment, maybe not with Finger Up My Butt or Pussy King, but it seems like Fucking Around and Drunk Sluts and If My Dick Is Up, Why Am I Down. Well, that's a pretty good lyric, but still, I mean, it's going to be tough to, get it on.
Yeah,
the
I was like, I was just, I'd spent so many years bumming around Nashville, trying to do it their way. I'm like, no more sense. I'm just going to, you write a song and then you kind of clean it up before you record it.
Yeah.
You put your first thoughts down.
Yeah, like, sure.
What if I made a record where I just didn't,
censor yourself.
I recorded the first drafts almost. It was kind of, I figured this was my last shot,
Well, why is that? I mean, what the fuck happened to you? I mean, I can say that here. I mean, it's like, when I saw you years ago, it sounded good. You're on the right trajectory. You're a little younger, but you know.
Well, 15 years of...
Of what?
Having my ass handed to me was just, I'd had enough, and I go, I want to put that shit down, onto a record.
And, honest.
And also, I knew it would piss off Nashville, so I'm like...
Well, I know, but isn't there a fine line? Like, what the hell happened to that first record? I remember there's a bunch of buzz on the first record. What was that? That was like fucking over 15 years ago.
It was, it was marketing shit,
Like, what happened?
Well, I blame, it was Bin Laden's fault. It was a 9/11,
The record came out on 9/11?
Yeah.
On that day?
Yeah.
Okay, but, I mean... Yeah, that's tough, but it's a record. It should still be out there. I mean, what's it called?
Well, it's called No Love for the City, because, I'm a country boy, so we put a,
So your album No Love for the City came out on 9/11.
And there was a picture, picture of the towers behind us. That was probably the bigger issue.
It's just you in front of the old World Trade.
Just because I never was a big fan of New York City, and that was the worst week to say that, obviously.
Well, it was a bad week for the record to come out. You had no control over that.
It's not my fault. Then after that, I think I took that, I internalized it and then just kind of took it, you know.
And so what happened after that?
You know, got another record deal, you know.
Yeah.
Fuck the CEO's wife or whatever. You know, that's the kind of shit that got me into trouble, you know.
You fucked the CEO's of the label's wife?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And that was probably...
Self-sabotage, maybe?
Yeah, I mean, I don't get that deep into it. I mean, it could have been, yeah.
You don't get that deep into it? But, I mean, was it worth it? Is it a good time? Or
looking back, I could have used the money more than night, but
then,
yeah.
Than the pussy?
Yeah, well...
What?
Looking back, that was definitely one of the dumber moves.
What are some other ones?
I mean, I would get in fights in the studio, fire the band, fire the producer, and then realize I'd blown... Because these record labels are more just like banks, you know? It's not like...
Uh-huh.
If I fire everyone, I go tell the label and they go,
uh-huh,
we don't have the money to hire anybody else. I can't just, you know...
So it's just you sitting alone in there, like, fuming?
Yeah, just, it's, you know, uh-huh, they got like, there's a lot of camera footage of me just, you know, smashing mixing boards. But I, you know, I would blow my advance on, you know, smashing, you know, guitars I smashed.
So you're a guy with a second record deal with the shit luck of having a record come out on 9/11 with other problems. So the first thing you do, or in that first year of the next record deal, you fuck the CEO's wife, you fire your band, you fire the producer, you've got no juice of your own, no real traction. So how long did it take for them to say, fuck you, the record label?
I mean, that one was, you know, pretty damn fast. I mean, probably, I would say it could be counted in hours, you know.
Oh, hours after you fired the producer and the band?
Yeah. Uh-huh. I think it was the fucking that got me.
So that all timed out, like the CEO found out you fucked his wife around the same time that you fired?
Yeah, well, I knew after that I was probably on my way out.
Yeah. So you're like, why not just burn it down?
Yeah, let's just burn it down. That's kind of what I'm doing with the new shit. Is just like, what's going to piss off Music Row the most?
Right.
Is playing this traditional country that I love, that they obviously hate since they're putting out all this pop shit. I'll put it out my way, you know, and...
Yeah.
And just...
So did Dave Cobb do this one too?
Yeah.
Oh, so you're working with a real guy.
I'm working with the best of the best. It's just, you know... Well, there's some legal issues on, you know, whether they're going to have their names on the final.
Oh, really?
We may have to put a sticker on
the
record.
Sure. So what? Why not just do, real country music that's not filthy?
I don't want to.
Well, I understand that. But, I mean, do you want to make a living? How are you making money? I mean, what are you doing? Is that...
This is, like I said, it's make it or break it time, really. It's like,
but that's happened before, it sounds like. I mean,
this one I just wanted to see, and it's a pretty fuck, these are crazy times out there. I wanted to see what would happen if I put out me, you know, Wheeler Raw, you know, put it out all out there, see what's happened.
But what have you been doing for the last 10 years? You don't drink, no, you didn't get fucked up, drugs,
no,
drinking?
I drank.
Oh, okay. All right. Did that become a problem? I mean, it just sounds like there's still a gap in time there that where you just hold up somewhere where you know.
Yeah, well, I guess time moves pretty fast when you're just drinking and sitting around the house and being upset, you know.
So you lost maybe a decade? Or
I would say I lost 7 years, not a
seven,
decade.
Seven. Yeah. So you don't remember what was going on? Did you have any?
Yeah, I mean, obviously the big thing for me was losing the wife, but.
Where'd she go? Is she dead?
No. Oh. I'd have to check my phone, but I don't think she is. But she'd had just about enough of me. So oddly, she digs the new record because this is me not trying to pretend to be somebody I ain't.
Oh, she says at least you're being honest. I'm glad I left, kind of deal. That maybe that's a good name for a song.
That's for not bad.
Yeah, like at least you're being honest.
Somebody write that now.
I'm glad I left. So are any of these songs about her? Like,
Fucking around is.
A fucking around's about
that's
her?
That's me and her, you know, fucking around each other. And she was supposed to sing on that one, but...
No good.
No.
She with another dude now?
No, she better fucking not be. I mean, we'll get back together, I'm sure.
Okay. Poon.
Poon is kind of my fuck you to Nashville.
That seems like all... That seems to be the theme, right?
Yeah, but that one I actually named names.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Like
The artists I don't like.
Oh, really? Know? Like?
Like Florida Georgia Line and... I even mentioned, you know, Reba and Garth Brooks just to, you know, try to start some
shit.
Yeah.
You think it's gonna, or you think they're just gonna be like,
I'm guessing, you know, like Garth don't check his Twitter that much.
Yeah. What are you gonna do? Like, if this doesn't work out, what are you, like 40 something now?
Yeah, I'm 42. I mean, I'll probably just move back my parents' farm and just sit around, you know?
Yeah. Is there any animals out there?
Yeah, we got a couple cows.
Yeah? Yeah, so your folks would have you back? You think you could just move into your old room, or?
No, they got a, well, they got a, we got like a little like farmhouse in the back. I'd sleep back there. You know, I'd probably be happy just hanging out there, see my old butt. A lot of my buddies growing up didn't really make it out of town even, so.
Oh, so they're all there?
Yeah, we just go get around, get fucked up, go to the bowling alley and shit.
And, right, so they'd just be like, he's back.
I think they expected me to be back sooner than that. They've been waiting for me since then anyway.
Well, I mean, well, I wish you luck. I don't think, you know, I mean, I don't know you, but I mean, it's a bold move. I don't know how you're going to get any airplay with this thing, but I hope you succeed in pissing off Nashville enough to make you feel like you've achieved something.
Yeah, it's like I felt like I was on my way out anyway. Let's just go out. Let's go out with the biggest fucking bang I can.
Yeah.
And
are you playing these songs live when you go out?
Yeah, yeah.
And people are enjoying it. You got a draw? Are the people coming to see you or what?
Well, we're about to tour. We're going to find out.
So. Oh, so you don't know? You haven't played any of them?
Yeah,
right?
I mean, my guess is no. And then like I said, this is kind of my. Most likely my swan song, so I wanted to go out and try to promote it.
But why do I feel like you're so committed to this? It almost feels like, you know, the best thing that could happen is this fails.
Maybe I just been at it too long, I think, you know.
Mm.
I don't think it's self-sabotage, really, like you said. I think it's more just like, I'm so fucking pissed, I can't take it anymore, like...
Right.
This look with Nashville, fucking look what you've done to me kind of thing.
But you look good. I mean, the cover, you look, you
yeah, no, I was,
together.
I mean, I put everything I had into the record, no doubt, but.
Right, but you kind of made it so it makes it very difficult for you to succeed, but you're going to feel good if you succeed in just.
It's almost like I'm thinking about the whole story, so I'm thinking about the end, too. It's like, oh. How to work out and then I can go, man, you should just.
Yeah.
I did the craziest fucking thing you'd ever seen.
So you're already thinking about. The stories you're going to tell your friends back at the farm.
Yeah, that's where I make the money on the book.
Oh, on the book?
Yeah.
So that you're looking ahead. You haven't started writing that yet.
No, I ain't going to, yeah.
Yeah.
don't they give you some guy to write it for you?
Sure, if they give a shit about you.
Yeah, well, that's a big if, I guess.
All right, man. Well, you know, best of luck with it. It's always nice talking to somebody who's... you know, got a, you know, is committed to their vision, you know what
Oh,
I mean?
Thanks, man. Yeah, you, same thing for you, man. I mean, it's cool to catch up with you again. Thanks for having, it's cool that I actually, there's about, we did the, you know, the we looked out and there's about 7 places.
Yeah.
Outlets where I'm allowed to even name the songs here. So it's cool that one of them, that
sure,
you said
I,
yes.
We can name a couple other ones. We got the dirty ones. You want to name like Small Town Saturday Night? That sounds like a regular country song.
Yeah, me and my buddy end up jacking each other off at the end of that song because we get bored.
Did that happen? All right.
I'll say no comment.
All right. How about Summers in Kentucky? That sounds nice.
Yeah, that's a pretty one. But yeah, that's one that I think we could get some radio play from. But
what happens in that one?
It's just like looking back at, you know, how much I miss the old days, about, you know, like getting old and
yeah,
like what my fucking life has turned into and how the girls my, you know, I've grown up with are now looking kind of nasty. I probably...
See, now they're like, they, you know, it's all going well until...
Yeah, that's what happens. About 2 minutes into that song, it kind of all falls apart.
But you say that like it's exactly what you wanted to do.
Yeah, well, I don't know that that song would have worked without me talking about the stretched out pussies and stuff, you know?
Yeah, I think that's...
There's people who would argue with that, I'm sure. But.
Well, no, a lot of songwriters I've talked to have run into that problem. They're like, how do I...
Oh, yeah, you've had some of the biggest...
Yeah.
Keith Richards have that problem? He was here, right?
He was here, but like usually they figure out another way to say it.
Yeah.
And I guess that's what makes you you, is the honesty.
Yeah, I never claimed to be Keith Richards, but...
you brought him up. I'm just saying that like I don't know that there's any Stone songs say... What a stretched out pussy, but yeah, I mean, but, on some I mean, level.
But yeah, I mean, I guess he's better at, you know, they had some pretty edgy shit that they
sure.
did. They did, so.
Sure, yeah.
I'm not as clever to figure out. I didn't want any innuendos. I didn't want to like.
Right.
It's like, it's 2017, enough of the fucking metaphors.
Right,
you know?
Yeah, Straight Shooter.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe that should be the title of your next record. Straight Shooter. That's probably already taken.
Oh yeah, it's got to be right.
Right, I don't know. We can Google it. Do you have a computer? Or you...
Yeah, I got. I mean, I got a phone. But,
all right. Well, you can do it on
Straight Shooter. That's a good fucking.
Yeah.
Can I just take that? Or?
I would. I would just take it and not even research it. See what happens. It seems to be in your kind of your thing. Like, you know, fuck you.
Yeah.
I didn't know. Maybe that's another good title. Fuck you. I didn't know. You think about that one?
Yeah, fuck you.
I don't know why I'm pitching you titles.
Yeah, fuck you. I didn't know you couldn't say you couldn't talk about pussies on the radio.
Well, that's a little long for a title.
But, yeah, I mean.
But I know what you're saying.
You know what I'm saying.
I do.
It's like, I want them to come to me, you know?
Yeah, sure.
I want them to go,
yeah.
You know what? We'll bleep it ourselves, because I ain't sending it out.
That's another good one. We'll bleep it ourselves. That's a good title for something.
Yeah.
Do you need to ride anywhere? Do you have a car? Or?
Well, my piece of shit manager just took his cousin to Disneyland or something. So, yeah, he'll be back. He said he'll be back in a little bit.
Like, what? Like how long?
I'll just wait outside. You know, what time
is it? You're going to wait out in front?
Yeah, I mean, it's be 6 hours max. I got my guitar. I can work on some tunes.
Out front?
Yeah. Do you mind?
No, it's all right. Just not in the yard. Like, at the end of the drive.
On the street?
Well, the sidewalk's fine.
All right, cool.
I mean, I can give you a bottle of water, too.
I would appreciate that.
All right, buddy. Well, thanks for talking.
Of course, man. Thanks, dude. Thanks for having me. And everyone go out and buy the record.
Again, the new Wheeler Walker Jr. record, Old Wheeler, is available at WheelerWalkerJr.com or wherever you get music. So, Ariel Levy. This book she wrote about her mom, the memoir, and where she's at emotionally, and her journey. I tell you, this interview took place in the evening, and I don't know if it got heavy, but a lot in common, and we just. I remember at some point where I was talking to her, and I'm like, God, we're just kind of working through stuff, aren't we? But the book is great, and it's available in paperback, An Abbreviated Life, a memoir, okay? It actually comes out tomorrow, June 13th. So this is me and Ariel in the garage talking some issues, some stuff, some family, some things. All right, let's do this. I remember you hanging around Luna Lounge. I remember it. I remember you. Like when you sent the book that you're going to tell me about.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I do remember you. I don't know if you told me An Abbreviated Life. That's the name of your book. But I don't know if you, like it was sent with, like, do you, I know you. Do you remember me? Did you?
No, I said you probably won't remember me.
But like, I do remember you. Why do I remember you? You were around. You must have been around.
I was around. I wasn't in the foreground.
Uh-huh. No, it was like Luna Lounge, right?
Right.
Mid-90s.
Right.
I don't know if I never asked you out or like I never, because I was sort of.
We didn't go out. That
not
I remember.
Even once. No. Not even for a dinner. Not no. For a coffee.
No.
Okay. But why were you hanging around comedy then?
I was working at MTV. I was working on a show, a comedy show.
Yeah.
At MTV. So I was with a lot of the comedy writers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was not really a part of it. I was more of an observer.
Right. A regular.
Yeah. And then I drifted away because I wasn't in the comedy scene.
Well, what did you end up doing?
Journalism.
Like, how does that go?
So in my that was in my early 30s.
Really? The comedy thing?
Luna, yeah.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Yeah, I think, I don't know, I'm 49 now. So
I'm 53. That was like 95, right?
I guess.
63.
Oh my God, it's like we're 90.
I know, it happens.
It's like,
you know what I mean? Like,
what was that back in the...
Well, it had to happen.
Back in the day.
Yeah, it is back in the day.
When they had taxis.
Yeah.
And they had you know...
There was still, it was still kind of filthy in New York,
yeah,
just barely.
Pay phones.
Oh yeah, pay
remember?
Phones. Sure, I do. I remember the first cell phones, pagers.
Beepers?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, so it was around that time. And then I got into journalism in my mid-30s.
Yeah.
And I started working for the Sunday Times magazine. So in England.
Uh-huh.
And I got...
How did that happen? Like, why England?
You know, so this is interesting.
Yeah.
It was after 9/11.
Yeah.
And I wanted to write a story on... what had happened to the Muslims in New York post 9/11. Because everybody was writing all of these stories about Americans, and I thought it was really important to get the voice of what was actually happening. Remember, they weren't allowed to go to the Statue of Liberty. And
sure, I was living two blocks away from Steinway Street in Queens.
Okay.
So it was crazy there. That was where, like, you know, like within a day or two, some kids went pissed off. New Yorkers went in and just broke up a coffee shop, you know, and there was a lot of like tension over there because all the Arabs are over there.
Right. So, yeah. So, and nobody wanted to do that story.
Yeah.
And if you remember, I think it was Susan Sontag wrote something for the New Yorker.
Right.
She was vilified.
Right.
So I had a story I wanted to do about some of the shopkeepers who were in the shadow of 9/11, you know, they had all those newsstands that were decimated.
Yeah.
And nobody would do it. And I pitched it to someone had said, you know, you should try England.
Yeah.
And I'd never really had
never
any connections.
That,
no, yeah. I'd read the Sunday Times and I was a big fan of The Guardian and, you know, a lot of these papers. But so this is a true story. I called up the switchboard at the Sunday Times magazine.
In England. Yeah.
There was actually a switchboard.
Yeah.
Like in I Love Lucy.
Yeah.
And they connected me to an editor in the features department.
Uh-huh. And you just said, I'm an American, I'm here.
I said I would like to write a story.
Yeah.
Who can I pitch it to?
Yeah.
And they gave me the name of the editor. That would never happen. I mean, can you imagine the New York Times? It's impenetrable. So I pitched the story, and he said to me, well, if you know, go ahead and write it, and if we like it, we'll run it. And I went off, and I reported it. And
where'd you go?
I went to some of the mosques, and I found a guy who had lost a business, and I really had no idea what I was doing, but I knew that I wanted to tell the story.
Yeah.
And then he ran it in their 9/11 anniversary issue.
Uh-huh.
He became the editor of the magazine, became like a mentor to me as a journalist. He said, you are pretty good at, you're terrible at reporting, but you're pretty good at interviewing.
Yeah.
So I sort of moved in that direction.
And
I started writing for the Sunday Times magazine.
Regularly.
Yep.
And that was your gig.
That was it. The first interview I did was Martin Scorsese.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
He's not hard to get talking.
No, exactly. Yeah.
That's not a tough interview, is it?
He's not shy.
No, he's just kind of going to guide him. Throw things into the machine that maybe trigger him in the direction you want, I would imagine.
It was fun.
Yeah.
It was fun. So I had a really, really great experience with journalism for about 10 years.
You stayed in New York?
I went back and forth.
Uh-huh.
Between London and New York.
That's exciting for your 30s.
Yep, 35 to about 44. And then everything changed.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
business?
Everything. Yeah. Because it was almost like this golden era.
Yeah.
Where there was an editor of the magazine and he had
like a newspaper.
Yeah, he had writers and we would all go out to dinner and talk about ideas. And then the budgets started getting slashed and, you know, and everything started to change. And once he left the magazine, I lost the contract and I went back to New York. And
did what?
Ugh, I had to start freelancing.
Uh-huh.
It was awful. And I'm very bad at it because I'm not really good at being pushy or hustling and chasing checks and it's freelancing.
I know. It's a pain in the ass.
So and then I got the book. So I wrote the proposal for the book.
So this brings us up to that. So like you wrote, you did the Times for 10 years, and
well,
for 10 years you wandered the freelancing plateau.
No, I did. So when I was at the magazine, I did a column. Mm-hmm. I did a humor column, pessimism. It was called Cassandra.
At the
Sunday
Times
magazine.
And so then, that was weekly?
Yep. Oh, I did
good.
It for 5 years.
Good gig.
Yeah.
Right?
It was hard. Writing a column, people think it's great because it's consistent, but you have to write a column every week.
You got to show up for work.
It's working.
What the fuck to write about.
Yeah.
I know. I do a weekly newsletter, so I dread it sometimes.
Well, do you ever run out of things to say?
Well, you know, fortunately for me, you know, over the last decade, I've focused primarily on me. So, like, if something happens to me, there's somewhere to go.
Right.
You know, I'm not really reaching out into the world. I'm reacting to it. So if I if I'm active in my life, even if it's going to a restaurant or if I travel, usually there's something.
Right.
You know, it's all memoir driven, I guess, in that way. I'm not looking at phenomena necessarily or commenting on something unless it moves through me.
Right.
Yeah.
But do you ever feel like there's nothing you have left to give?
Yeah, all the fucking time. I feel it now. And, you know, now, like, you know, it's all very crushing. You know, there's a, you know, the my fundamental inability to experience, you know, gratitude or happiness or joy is now only kind of buttressed by, you know, the political climate we're in now. You know, like, my brain is always going to go there anyways, but now it's like, there's a reason.
Right.
You know.
Right.
That, you know, that's the way my self-centeredness works. So that, you know, I'm prone towards anxiety and depression, but usually it's self-generated over bullshit. You know, so now it's sort of like, no, now we got something.
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, so my brain's sort of like, I'm in, I'm occupied.
Right. But does it ever have, like, there must be gradations of it, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, it took me a long time to realize that, you know, that I wasn't a depressive, that, you know, it was really, you know, profound anxiety and panic and dread that, you know, fluctuated, you know, either through anger or through just, you know, kind of paralysis. But it was not like, it wasn't a depression as much as it was an exhaustion, you know, which I was able to track towards more anxiety.
What's the trigger for your anxiety?
I think that, like, the trigger is in some way, you know, and it's normal. Is I think most people just don't think about it as much. Is anticipating bad things. You know, the trigger is like, I don't know what's going to happen there.
The,
like,
not, you know, knowing.
Yeah.
Personally, as well as in the world.
Well, I think, like, I just experience a lot of dread. My first thought is always sort of like, well, this is going to be shitty, or this is going to be scary, or I'm in trouble. You know what I mean? That, like, I think that was my way of getting through to my parents. Like, I had to be in crisis to get attention in some way, you know, because that's the way my parents, their selfishness sort of, you know, they were, I think, worried. I don't know if they were good at, I know they weren't good at, you know, loving or nurturing, but they were good at worrying.
Were they good at reassuring?
No, not at all.
Okay.
No, and it was always sort of, they always put the question back on me. Like yeah, it's going to be all right, right? And my mother would be like, I don't know, is it? You know, that kind of thing. Right. So it was very nebulous.
Right.
Like, yeah, I was very confronted with sort of the need to attempt self-parenting at a very young age. There was really no help with the reassurance there.
Right. Well, that's what the anxiety is about. It's about seeking that kind of safety and reassurance.
Right. And there isn't any now.
Right.
So it's like really horrendous. Yeah. And nobody's going to tell you it's going to be okay, that you're going to believe.
Right.
Yeah.
But in a way, it's also kind of freeing, because we're all going to die.
Well, we are going to die anyways. I just didn't think we'd all do it together.
But then there's a kind of, what is that? Misery loves company.
Yeah, well, that's a big problem. You know, like, you got to, even before whatever's happening now happened, you know, you got to keep moving. But, you know, usually I was driven by a compulsion or just whatever it was to keep moving.
Right.
But, like, right at the point where I was like, I think I'm ready, I can ease up now because I've done okay. I've achieved some things. Then this happens. So now I'm like, well, now there's no possibility for joy or whatever. But, you know, that's you know, my brain. But, like, from your book, you know, which is really about, you know, growing up with, you know, profound aggressive narcissism, you know, fortunately, like, it seems like your mother ran the gamut of emotional, that there was an emotional spectrum there. It wasn't all just abuse. There was the need for, you know, sympathy and victimness and all that shit. I mean, my dad was like that too, but My father didn't have an elaborate a life as your mother.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, when did this stuff, the repercussions of this, you know, because I imagine they were unidentified throughout your life, you know, in terms of, like, you felt a certain way, which wasn't good, but you, when
numb.
Did you, numb.
Yeah.
When did you start to track that as being pathological or an issue? Like, I mean, you know, you're working at MTV or whatever, you're a kid, you've got your own, we got our problems in our 20s and our 30s, but I mean, this was not unlike me, you know, once you get the key in to tracking it to that, directly to your how you were brought up, then, you know, you start to look back and like, oh, all of this shit was because of this. When did that start happening?
Oh, gosh, there wasn't, it wasn't like it was one tectonic moment. It was, I think, a series of moments that cumulatively added up to, I got to a point where I was in my mid-40s and I just felt, I mean, the title of the book, An Abbreviated Life, refers to living a life within brackets. Like, I was functional.
Yeah.
I was, you know, I was able to have a career. I had friends. I had a life.
Yeah.
But on the inside, I never felt, I never had any feeling of safety. I never felt, you know, the ground was always shifting beneath me.
Right, right.
And I had no center of gravity.
So were you a drain on your friends?
I am, I'm pretty sure I was. I thankfully have very loyal friends.
Right, because for me, like, I always had one or two that were just there.
Yeah.
And you don't, at the time, you don't really give them credit for knowing just how nutty you are.
That's true.
But like, clearly the good friends that you have know that.
That's true. That's true. And most of my close friends are friends I've had all my life.
Oh, yeah?
Or, you know, at least 20 years.
Yeah. Oh, you know Martha Plimpton?
Yes.
She's
an old
here.
Childhood friend.
Great. Well, yeah, you grew up in all that crazy New York shit.
Yeah, yeah.
That, like, you know, the world that your mother comes from and that her mother came from, that sort of weird 1970s intelligentsia, theater, art, fashion, literature world was like, that was a big deal then. They dictated culture.
Right, right.
And you grew up in that.
I did, yeah.
Yeah.
And it was almost like, and I wrote about this in the book, that bad behavior was excused.
Right.
You know, it was a very self-indulgent time.
Right.
So if you were an artist, you could get, you know, it was, you could get away with the kind of bad behavior that, you know, to a certain extent, my mother got away with. Separate of how it was with her as a parent, I think that, you know, that kind of indulgence was accepted.
And it's very specific what you went through, but I don't think that having a bad behaving narcissistic parent is cultural. I mean, I think it happens at all tiers of families.
Right.
Yeah. You know, but like your story is like, it takes place in, you know, what a lot of us romanticize.
Right, which for me was really very unappealing.
Oh, really?
I wanted a very conventional home with a mother who was cutting crusts off the sandwiches. Uh-huh. You know, like, yeah. I wanted that.
Did you have friends that had that?
I did.
Yeah.
I did, yeah. And by the way, I would say to my mother, I wish you were more of a of a mommy. That's what I call it.
Yeah.
You know?
They don't like that.
No, because she, of course, you know, I was completely ungrateful for having her as a poet and an artist and a mother. So.
Well, I always pushed back. You know, like, that was, I think, the one thing that saved me in terms of, like, I always fought them.
Right.
You know, I always pushed. And, like, I remember a breakdown on a family trip where I'm like, why can't you be more like Eric's parents?
Hmm.
And there was just, like, crying in the car and my father going, why don't you go fucking live with them? You know, fuck you.
It's always go live with them.
Yeah. You know, and it was like crazy.
Right.
It was crazy. It just, you know, I don't, but.
Well, because they feel taken for granted and it's all about them.
It's all about them. But I, like, you know, and I hate to admit it, I do not think they knew how to do it differently.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I don't like to let them off the hook, but they're still, like, they are what they are. And, you know, they didn't, you know, I don't know.
They're still together?
No.
Oh, okay.
But they're alive.
Okay. Okay. That's something.
So you're okay. Right. So let's go back before we get into the core of it. Like, so you're in your 40s.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're starting to realize you feel you don't have any grounding, but you're a bit of a control freak, right?
Definitely.
Because you go either way. Like, you know, kids of alcoholics or kids of narcissists or whatever the problem is, either you do everything to manage your environment or you just become like them. Right. There's only two ways to go.
Right.
Either you're a drunk or you're a person that would never drink and can't stand drunks.
Right.
Yeah.
Or you're a person who would never drink but doesn't care to be around drunks.
Mm-hmm. So a polite control
right.
freak.
Right. Right.
So you're a polite control freak?
I would say that's correct. Not to be too specific.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
But
your mother wasn't a drunk.
She did drink, but right. that wasn't the least of it.
So what do you do in your 40s when you find that, like, you know, I imagine if it wasn't a tectonic, is that the word you used?
Yeah.
Shift, you know, it was a problem.
I had gotten to a point where I felt I was so imprisoned by my past that I didn't want to be tyrannized by it anymore.
And you still had a relationship with her at that point.
I did, yeah.
So you were tyrannized because you were constantly triggered by engaging with her.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
I was afraid.
Yeah.
I was afraid of her as an adult the way I had been afraid of her as a child.
And that's sort of the abbreviated life idea, right, on another level, which is like, you know, as soon as you engage with them, the emotional interaction is timeless.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. And when you're a child and you're helpless, you feel helpless as an adult.
Ugh.
So that powerlessness had not left me, you know? And I think that the cumulative effect of it, always acquiescing and always making it easy so that I didn't have to engage and have the conflict, created this sense of going through life with an armor on.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. But that only acts to insulate that, you know, terrified kid.
Right.
Yeah.
You don't evolve.
Yeah. Right.
So
right.
You get to a point where then you're ready to evolve.
What'd you do outside of write the book?
Well, I did a therapy called EMDR.
I got a buddy that is one of the big practitioners of that.
It's great.
I did it. I have recordings of me doing it.
You do?
Yeah.
And did it help you?
I think in the moment it did. I do not think I went deep enough. Right. Explain it a little, because I mean, he talked about it. And, you know, explain to me what it sets out to do, because it's a bizarre kind of thing that could easily be dismissed as something almost huckstery, you know.
Right, right. Well, it's used mostly for people with PTSD.
Yeah, a lot of vets.
Right.
And
what it does, I mean, obviously I'm not a spokesperson or
sure,
a
but like
therapist.
When it was pitched to you, when how did you find?
I started to do it because my therapist, my long-time therapist, became a practitioner.
Uh huh.
So I would not have known about. I didn't seek it out.
Yeah.
And she said to me, "I think this would be very helpful for you."
Yeah.
I was completely cynical.
Yeah.
Going into it, thinking of obviously.
Yeah.
Thinking it wasn't going to work. And when she told me about it, it seemed great, you know, like it's bilateral stimulation.
Uh-huh.
So you have, you're hearing sounds, beeps in your ears, and you're seeing, you know, watching
moving light. Yeah.
And what that's doing is it's stimulating your right brain and left brain at the same time.
Uh-huh.
Right. But what the point of what it does is that there are memories that are frozen, like that have you frozen emotionally. So you have reactions to things and you feel certain consequences of things that aren't necessarily logical.
Or right? in the current reality.
Right.
Yeah.
And by going through this process, it's like unfreezing those memories.
Yeah, because they remain kind of like on a loop.
Right. And you're reacting as though that is still, you're frozen in that time.
Right. Interesting.
And so
it breaks the loop.
Yeah. I think of it almost like melting the memories.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And you're able to then see, like in my case, without getting into too much about it, I was able to recognize, I was not responsible for her.
Right.
Behavior. Like, that's who she was. I was just a kid.
Yeah.
Trying to grow up.
Yeah.
And I saw her for who she was.
Right.
Rather than feeling the anger and the outrage and the, you know, all of the pain.
Yeah.
I could actually see it.
Yeah.
Like, from a distance.
Right.
Which was very helpful.
You could separate the two of you.
Right.
Right. Interesting. So where?
So I think you should. I think you should do it.
I did a little bit, and I did find some success with it. I think that PTSD, obviously, there's a spectrum of it, but I do think it's a real thing. Mm. And I did find some relief around some things. You know.
Right.
But you know, again, it was him doing it here.
In the garage?
Yeah. I did. We recorded it. I don't know what I'm going to do with it.
Oh, okay.
But I was in it.
I don't know if that's the most effective.
No, I know.
To do a podcast of EMDR.
I didn't put it up.
Okay.
Because I did get choked up, and you know it is very vulnerable place as you know when you're in it.
I was afraid I was going to have a psychotic break.
Really?
Yes, I was very. I was nervous.
Going into it or during it.
Going into it, I was afraid that it would you know, that I would open a door to memories I had blocked out for a reason.
Yeah.
And I was scared. And I didn't, by the way, of course. I had to play out the worst case scenario.
Right,
beforehand.
To prepare yourself.
Of course. I had to. Yeah. You have to.
That's what you do.
And then what happened was when you do a timeline of, you know, it's hard to, I won't get into all the specifics, but I'm sure you understand. Like you have to talk about ahead of time some of the
stuff.
The stuff.
Around the trauma. Yeah.
But in my case, it was sort of a chronic feeling of aloneness.
Yeah.
So how do you isolate that?
You pick outstanding memories of that.
Yeah. Times when I felt completely helpless.
Yeah.
And that helped.
And that, too. Was this before you wrote the book?
Yeah.
So when you were going through those things, were you like, this is going to go in the book?
No.
No, like this memory's going in.
No. Because I think unlike you, when you did your EMDR, I wasn't like thinking, oh, maybe I'll do something with this.
I know, but did things come up that you hadn't really thought about in a long time?
You mean memories?
Yeah.
A lot of that. Well, what was weird was that I found it wasn't the headline traumas that did the most damage.
Oh, yeah?
It was like little things, like a promise being broken or...
Yeah.
You know, right. Something.
No, yeah, I got those memories. Like just weird little moments of hurt.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That were so profoundly disappointing.
Yeah.
That you wouldn't have, you know, you don't walk around telling people like, oh, and then when I was 8 years old, she broke a promise to have dinner with me. You know, it wasn't as though they were that significant.
Yeah.
But it came up that those very innocuous moments were actually very, painful.
Yeah, because that pain of rejection or embarrassment.
Invisibility.
Yeah, well, that's a big one. See, that's one thing that I always did throughout my upbringing with selfish parents was I ranted and raved a lot. Mm. I demanded to be seen.
Did they hear you?
Yeah, sometimes. Like, there were ways, you know. My old man, they were sort of like, I think they were kind of taken aback that I was so cocky and so opinionated and so charismatic. So there was a default to it. I mean, my dad would be pretty brutal emotionally. And my mother was somewhat detached, but I think that because of my charisma or intelligence or my desire to know things, they were kind of like, well, he seems like he's going to be all right.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, he seems to have his own thing. Like they were displaced as parents. And like inside, I was just like being erased constantly.
Right.
You know.
Right. But so did they disavow your feelings?
I don't know, it always became confusing. It wasn't, there was manipulation like you experienced, I think, but it was more sort of like, they were sort of detached. My father was very detached and my mother was very indecisive. There wasn't much discipline. There was no helping with the homework. There wasn't necessarily that much interest in what I was doing. You know, in terms of feelings, if I was upset or sad, I think it embarrassed my mother somehow and she would laugh at me a lot. My father would, you know, like he was just very emotionally detached. So there wasn't any, you know, like you stink or you're terrible.
Mm-hmm.
There was a little bit of like, you know, why can't you do better?
Mm-hmm.
You know, what's the matter with you? But it wasn't, the competition became more pronounced later, like when I was a teenager. Then it felt like I threatened him. I threatened the old man or I threatened her somehow. But where did it start with you? So you grew up wealthy. right? Like Upper East Side?
Yeah, I mean, I had a very bohemian
life. That's right, I'm sorry. Man, wealthy's not right. You grew up like New York arty.
Yeah.
And your mom was an artist.
Yeah. Yeah, my mother was an artist and a great poet and a great writer.
Known for it.
Yep.
Famous.
As famous as a poet can be, right?
Right, but she was tapped into
relative.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, but at that time.
There were a lot of people around who, you know, admired her as an artist.
But like, so. I just picture that scene that I used to see on like television in the 70s, you know, like you watch Dick Cavett or something.
Yeah.
And, you know, you'd see, you know,
Dick Cavett was great.
Yeah.
He's still alive.
I know.
Yeah.
You see George Plimpton, Norman Mailer, you know, Andy Warhol, this scene that really kind of was at the forefront of culture, even in stand-up to some degree in the late 70s, that New York,
right,
that world of that generation of bohemians were real rock stars.
Right.
And this is after, well, maybe during the factory, right, Warhol?
A little bit after, yeah.
So, like, we're heading into the 80s where everything is...
No, it was in the 70s.
Yeah.
It's in the early 70s.
And you're, like, a kid. How old?
I would say between 0 and 10. So, 68 to 78.
All right, so you're young.
Yeah, and I was a kid.
And it's crazy. What's going on? Who's coming over? What are you dealing with?
Oh, well, there was raucous parties on weeknights, which was, you know, very disturbing to me because there would be a lot of people there who, I guess, you know, you now as an adult would think was exciting.
Like, right.
You know, Norman Mailer and Andy Warhol. And
they were there.
Yeah.
At your apartment, but drinking, yelling.
I was a kid who needed to sleep. Right. So I would come out of my bedroom.
In your nightie?
In my nightgown.
Yeah.
And open the door and shout into this crowd of crazy artists, like, can everybody please go home? I have to go to school tomorrow. I have to go to sleep. And my mother would say, after the belly dancer, or, you know, come join the party.
And Warhol's just standing there.
He was
detached and odd, and
I mean, you know, I wrote.
They're smoking in there, and they're drinking.
They would come in my room, you know, and I'm an only child, so I was really
to talk to you,
to talk to me, to sit, to smoke, to get away from the crowd, to use my bathroom.
Oh my God.
You know, it was a
just like smelly alcohol, boozy, arty people,
and I was. Like, I felt the only adult, you know?
At that time, really?
And I was about 8 years old. And I think people would...
Did you feel that, or are you putting that back into it? Did you feel like the only adult, or is that something...
I don't think I had the intellectual capacity at that time to recognize it, but I think my constitution was, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah.
Why are these people behaving so inappropriately?
Yeah,
I'm a kid.
Right.
Like, I shouldn't be the one telling them to be quiet.
Sure.
You know, in my head, that's what was going on.
Then they probably thought you were a precocious, cute kid. Oh, look at her, you know, the little square.
Yeah, or they thought I was a brat.
Oh, right.
You know, like, oh, she's such a party pooper.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Because they're all infantilized grown-ups.
Right.
Yeah.
So I was like, you know, the bratty kid who was telling everyone to go home.
And then how did this, like, and then what, how'd your mother answer for this? What was the relationship?
Well, my mother was very, she was like a kid herself, of course, you know, so
emotionally.
Yeah. And she also, you know, she loved entertaining and she loved being the center of attention. And
so
what would happen is the next day, I mean, I was always negotiating for peace.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was like making her promise, please don't have dinner parties on weeknights. Can you just have them on the weekends?
Yeah.
You know, and then she would say, okay. And then they would come, you know, the dinner parties would be on the week. There was no consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say to her the next day, you know, something about this is too much for me. I have to go to school. And she would say, what's the big deal?
Right.
You know, so it was sort of, and that was a, you know, kind of a facet of gaslighting because my perception was being canceled and overwritten, you know.
Right. So gaslighting is a theme throughout this thing.
In the book,
Because you did the TED Talk on gaslighting.
Yeah.
Let's explain that, because you know I hear the word now, and I've had to look it up and try to understand what it means. I get it.
Oh, you hadn't heard it?
I think I'd heard it, but I don't think I saw it in so much common usage until recently. But I heard it, but I didn't know exactly what it was until a few months ago.
Right, right.
And you did a TED Talk on gaslighting.
I did it on surviving gaslighting.
But this is something that happens in interpersonal relationships. It's explain what it is.
Well, gaslighting is when someone manipulates you into questioning your sanity.
Uh-huh.
That's probably the most, distilled down.
A relationship. Yeah. Any relationship.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess you could say that for people like us. But it has, it's obviously, and it can come in various different forms. And sometimes it's when you see things with your own eyes, mm-hmm. and that you're told you didn't see.
Right.
I don't know whether I should talk about it politically now. The reason people are talking about it is because things are happening that are being denied.
Right.
And when reality is denied, that's a form of gaslighting.
In a big way. And it's a tactic to destabilize and take power in this particular example you're making.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's a real tool, or it's deployed by extreme narcissists.
Right.
So
is that generally the case?
Yeah.
So,
and it's a form of abuse.
Okay.
Psychological abuse.
So when did you, get this key into your childhood? I mean, when did, because it feels like that would be a tectonic moment to have a name for it.
Oh, there was a moment in my, I talked about this, in my 20s, which now feels like 100 years ago, that I confronted my mother. I never really confronted her because I knew there was total futility. It would always backfire and make things worse. But I did confront her once and said the words out loud, child abuse. And I said it in this very playful way, so she didn't feel attacked.
Right.
What about child abuse?
Yeah.
And her response to that was, what about mommy abuse?
Right.
And no one ever talks about that.
Right.
And I knew in that moment that everything that I had experienced was disavowed.
She didn't see it. She couldn't see it.
Couldn't see it. Couldn't have
empathy.
An acknowledgement.
Yeah.
Which is important.
And that's like real narcissism.
Yeah. And that, I think, crystallized for me.
Yeah.
It was sort of like, all right, now I have to recognize I'm never going to get the wish for it to be different.
Yeah.
And that's the most powerful thing, is when you have a parent, you want so desperately to be loved in the way that you need to be loved.
Yeah.
That it's hard to give up the wish.
Yeah. No, I know. Yeah. Yeah, definitely. But it's interesting because my experience with my father's narcissism is that, he could get sad, and he was sad a lot.
Mm.
And, when, sort of pressured to sort of even, take ownership of any of my feelings, he couldn't quite do it. He would bring it back to I remember when I was doing this and that and the other thing, but you always do this. It always goes back to me.
Right.
I know you, you're like this. And then it becomes like, you're just me. The way I sort of characterize it is that a narcissist see you as sort of some sort of extension or prosthetic limb of theirs.
Right.
There's no boundary there.
Right.
So if you're acting up, it's some sort of weird problem they're having with a limb almost. And they just need to get it behaving properly so it fits the body.
Right, right. Like, it couldn't possibly be that you have these feelings on your own.
That you're a different person.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But does he feel... on the flip side of that, does he feel that he can take credit for your success?
I don't know that he, is able to acknowledge it fully. He is now, because it becomes undeniable. And I wrote a book and I had some stuff about him in it, and it leveled him. Like, you know, he got paranoid. He, you know, felt betrayed. He got nervous for his own reputation. I don't even know if he read it. And, you know, he just hears about it. Like, he just has a detachment from almost everything I do. And he's primarily, since the book, preoccupied that I'm going to bring him into it. He used to get a real kick out of me when it wasn't, you know, directed at him.
Right, right.
And then I had to really question my intentions about writing about him. You know, was it spite? Or, you know, is it part of my story?
Right, right.
Is it a betrayal? Did I handle it right? You know?
Hmm. Do you feel that way because of you're afraid of hurting him?
Well, I think gaslighting and Stockholm syndrome have some crossover.
Right.
Right?
Right. Overlap, yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I guess gaslighting is the more self-aware component of beating Stockholm syndrome, of identifying with the oppressor. And right? Because they're always in your head.
That's true. Yes, I hadn't thought about that. That's true.
You know, so they're you know, they live in you.
Right.
So you're always going to kind of like go to their point of view in there.
Because you're also seeing it from their perspective.
Yeah.
Right.
And so, like, I don't know how I really felt. I felt like really what it comes down to is I felt like this was a radical way of establishing a boundary. And I did not regret that.
Right. Right. No, I think that I felt that way, too. I mean, when I wrote, for me, writing the book was because it was crossing a threshold.
Mm-hmm.
I really didn't think about it being published. I thought about I'm writing this book because I always felt if I'm going to jump off a roof, I have to write this book first.
Right.
So it was a book that had to be written.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could get on with my life.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I did feel that way to a certain degree, but like there is also this idea that you're going to show them once and for all on some level.
Yeah. I never had that. I can't say I had that because I felt she wasn't going to learn a lesson.
Hmm.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't going to get through to her.
Right.
And she is who she is, and she is the way she is, and the only thing I could do was look out for
myself.
But
you didn't think it was going to hurt her?
Everything hurts her.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was a feeling of I had to put myself first.
Yeah, right.
So, and I think that in some ways... the feeling, I mean, this is a bigger conversation about memoir in general, but I think that you're always betraying someone when you tell the truth.
Yeah.
Right?
And right.
You have to decide to, you know, in my case, I had managed her feelings for so long that I really had, and maybe this answers it's a circuitous way of getting back to your question, but I think I learned I had to put myself first.
Right.
And that was okay.
Yeah.
That it was protecting myself. It wasn't being self-centered.
Right. It was allowing you to maybe, you know, grow that scared kid up, to integrate your body. You know, like,
right.
You know what I mean?
Yep.
Like, you know, how am I going to find the space if this woman lives in my head?
Right. Right. Or that if I'm always thinking of what's going to, how do I get what I need by managing what she needs first?
Uh-huh.
You know?
Yeah.
Like if she's okay, I'm okay.
Uh-huh.
So that's how I grew up as a kid. Like I really had to make sure she was calm because when she was calm, then I could be calm.
Right. Well, well, that's the weird thing. But you don't talk to her now?
At the moment, no.
For how long?
It's been about two. Well, like, I guess, I don't know, but I can't, 3 years, to know, yeah. I like, say, I don't know, we had one conversation before the book came out,
mm-hmm.
So.
Yeah, because I've gone through periods with him where I don't talk to him, and like, in, you know, if I'm vulnerable, I try not to engage with him, but I'm still the guy, unlike my brother, who continues to resent him, like, I engage with this fucking guy, you know, I deal with him.
And do you, are you close to your brother?
Yeah.
Right.
And I get it, but like, you know, I still try to navigate him.
What would happen if you didn't?
Well, you just, you know, it's just like what I notice is like, I don't as that much, you know, but I do need to, you know, like, because I've had some success in my life and I, you know, and he, you know, kind of blew his, that, you know, there is like years previous, I would be like, well, it's not my problem. But now, like, you know, I have a little more empathy and, you know, the biggest, I just try to stay out of his sadness because he will try to draw me in. And if I show vulnerability, he will try to exploit it one way or the other. You know, we use the window. Mm. If I have any vulnerability, then he'll sort of exacerbate it to keep a connection.
Right. But he doesn't require 24 hours of time and attention.
No, he used to. Oh. He used to, you know, call me up and, you know, like he's going to kill himself and, you know, he's, you know, like.
Right. The emotional manipulation.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, totally. You know, and that's still sort of there, but like I can manage it, but it makes me sad.
That it's still there?
Well, just that, like, you know, like I have to protect myself from it.
Right.
You know what I mean? And I could choose not to engage with him, but it's hard not to do that without seeming hostile.
Right.
So I try to do the kind of like mature check in with the old man thing.
Yeah, it's like parenting yourself.
Like, well, that's what you got to learn to do, right? So what was the boundary situation, though? How, like, you know, outside of having to, you know, kind of be the grown up in it, you know, how did she, you know, annihilate the boundaries?
Well, there are no boundaries.
Right, because you're just part of her.
Yeah, there was no, and that was something that I recognized later on.
Yeah.
Because I was in that situation not knowing what was appropriate or not.
And
are you speaking about something in particular that you weren't?
Well, I mean, the parts that, you know, I read or that you talked about a little bit elsewhere were, you know, these weird games and these, you know.
Oh, the being born.
Yeah.
Right.
That's profoundly disturbing.
Yeah. But what was very, I think, trenchant about that, putting that story in the book.
Yeah.
Was not because it was a disturbing story. It wasn't there to be a disturbing story.
No, right.
What was disturbing about it was that it wasn't disturbing to me.
Right.
That what everybody would say was such a disturbing story to me was just everyday life.
Well, what was the game?
So the game was called Being Born.
And how old were you?
I was about 6 years old.
Yeah.
And I should, just to put this in context,
yeah.
I talked about this story in therapy when I was in my 40s
uh-huh.
for the first time.
Uh-huh.
And my therapist, when I told her this story,
mm-hmm.
or, like, the look on her face was total shock and horror. And she was like, how have you not mentioned this in like 20 years of therapy?
Yeah.
You know, and I was like, I don't know. It just didn't have any emotional resonance to me.
Uh-huh.
Because I think I was so conscious of my mother's role, which was that for her, it was a very playful and fun thing.
Uh-huh.
You know, it wasn't salacious or titillating.
Right. Sure. Right. Well, it wasn't sexual abuse.
Right.
Right.
It was just completely inappropriate balance.
Right. Yeah. I'm familiar with that.
So anyway, the game was that I would come home from school and she would say, let's recreate the happiest day of my life
mm-hmm.
when I gave birth.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get into bed with her and she would be naked and I would go under the sheet and still be in my school uniform.
Yeah.
And she would recreate giving birth.
And you'd pop out?
And she would, you know, do the heaves and the sighs and
uh-huh.
On the count of three, pop, and then I would come out uh-huh. of the sheet, and she would, you know, rock me in her arms like I was an infant and kiss me, and then
that was probably the only time she felt like she had complete control over you.
I think for her it was really just a fun game, you uh-huh. know. And the
and he played it a lot.
Well, you know, for me it was an opportunity to have my mother's attention,
right,
which was huge. You know?
Yeah.
And we played, one day she played actually with a friend of mine who came over.
Mm-hmm.
And then that friend wasn't ever allowed to come over again.
Why?
Well, she probably went home and said, you know.
Oh, like, you mean from her end?
Yeah. Right. Like her mother was probably like, what did you do at Ariel's house?
Yeah.
She's like, well, her mother got naked and we played Being Born.
Yeah, that was the end of that.
She's like, yeah, you're not going over there again.
Oh, boy. I have a story about, like, they're, like, it seems like my parents are self-involved and they were, as they were not, my mother was very insecure. Mm. And my father, obviously narcissist at the core of it, are paralyzingly insecure. You know, like,
right.
you know, almost to empty in a way. But there was a story that my mother thought was so funny was that, like, one time when I was like 3 years old, I fell and I hit my head on the table and I was crying and my mother felt terrible. So what she did in that moment was she went and smashed her own head into the table so she could be in pain, like feel what I was feeling.
Right. Like that's so sweet.
Right. It's so fucked up.
It's I totally understand why, as a kid, you would think that was like the most empathetic thing.
I imagine I was shocked. I mean, I imagine she took it all away.
Hmm.
There was nothing comforting about it. It was like the exact opposite. I don't know how I responded to it, but I would imagine I'd be like, what the fuck?
Right.
You know, like the I think the instinct should be like, come here, it'll be okay. Not like, well, now we're both fucked.
Or,
you know,
right.
Now who helps us?
Right. See, I'm so, my perception of that was she wanted to feel the pain you were feeling so that she and you could be one.
Yeah, right. Yeah, but no one's helping the pain.
But you're looking at it from a logical perspective, which is
right.
Totally.
She had an opportunity there to you know, kind of move me through it,
right?
And just decided to have no boundaries at all and hijack the situation with her fucking insanity,
right?
She's gotten very contrite about it all and tries her hardest to behave properly now.
Does she have remorse?
Yeah.
Does that help you?
Sometimes. It's just the saddest part about all of it, really, for me, with, I don't know what role your father played in your life. Where was he?
In Thailand.
Just avoiding everything? They were married and...
They were divorced when I was two, and he went back there, and I would spend time with him there.
Why was he there? He worked for who?
Well, he's a lawyer, and he worked in... When he met my mother, he was working for the State Department in Hong Kong.
Oh, okay.
But he was living in Southeast Asia my whole life.
Mm.
So I would spend part time in New York with her, and then I would have like this respite where I would go spend time.
It was a relief?
It was, because I was away from the anxiety and the chaos.
Right. And he knew about the anxiety and the chaos?
Yeah.
But he couldn't do anything about it, other than just be there for you when you were there.
Yeah. He was powerless.
Mm. Well, I think the biggest regret I have is that, like, I do not look to them for any sort of help emotionally. It's got to be a pretty dire situation that's very focused, you know, because, like, if I talk to my mother, I'll act like if I need help or I'm in some sort of pain or something, I'll act like my father and, you know, just defy her to help me, and then she can't, and then I make her feel shitty. And with him... You know, if I ask him for help, then it just becomes this nightmare where I have to disengage myself from him. So I just, there's no sort of like, you know, I can just call my parents. It was never helpful.
Right.
It never, like, you know.
Right. But that nurturing, which I think, you know, that's a loss. Like, you feel the loss. You have to grieve for that.
Yeah.
I believe you do. Yeah. Because... That's what every kid should have as an essential. I mean, people talk to me about, oh, I had this great life. I grew up in Manhattan, around all these famous people. I just wanted to be able to feel safety and cared for and heard. Mm. You know, those are the nutrients that a kid needs in order to really grow up and feel safe in the world.
Yeah.
And so I think when you recognize that you didn't have that, there's a period of time that you have to kind of, it's like a death.
Yeah, you know? No, I agree. And I deal with it. I know where the problems are. I know that the intimacy stuff is difficult. I know that trust is difficult. I know all that stuff.
But knowing it and then actually,
transcending it, moving through it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard because it's fucking scary. Because you don't have the tools for it. Right. You didn't have it. You don't have it. You know, you don't have nurturing wired into you, and you don't have trust wired into you.
Right.
So it's a lot to ask for from somebody sometimes. It's a real pain in the ass, the wrestling, emotional wrestling match that has to go on just for you to feel safe for fucking 5 minutes.
I know. And then it doesn't have traction. It's a constant.
No. Yeah, it doesn't stick.
Right.
Yeah,
like it has to be.
Yeah, you got to find somebody where they're like, okay, here we go.
Again.
Starting from square one.
Again.
Yeah.
Right.
Ugh.
But the trust thing is really, that's the killer.
Well, when you publicly talk about gaslighting, what is the arc of that conversation? I mean, you know, you're talking about relationship with your mother, where your reality was
canceled
and destabilized to supplement her impulses. Yeah.
And by the way, she couldn't help herself.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's where the compassion comes in.
Later.
Right. And in the moment, I had no idea.
But how did that play out in your life? I mean, how many relationships did you go through?
Did I burn through?
Well, I mean, like, what is the arc of that conversation? I imagine you're doing a TED Talk that has some positive closure. Isn't that the punchline of a TED Talk?
The positive closure is the healthy detachment, I think, that first of all, I should say when I did the talk, I wrote it like a writer.
Uh-huh.
And then what I learned in the process was that, and you're a performer, I'm not.
Right.
When you're speaking to people in an audience, you can't, it's a totally different type of writing. You know, like you have to really, you have to make connections for them because they don't have time.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like reading a book.
Right.
So the arc of that talk was the comment that was made to me by this stranger. Well, he wasn't a stranger. He'd been at my house when I was a kid at one of my mother's parties.
Oh, yeah?
And I met him as an adult. He's a writer who, when I went to go have the first interview I had with the man who became my editor at the Sunday Times magazine.
Yeah.
He showed up at the end of that.
Just out of nowhere.
Well, he was having dinner with him.
Okay.
They were having dinner.
And did you have oh my God, kind of?
No, I didn't recognize him. I was introduced to him.
Uh-huh.
Because the last time I'd seen him, I was 5 years old.
Yeah.
So my editor, Robin Morgan, introduced me to him.
Yeah.
And he later said to him, I'd always thought there were only two options for that little girl, suicide or murder. Okay, it was a great line.
Uh-huh.
And because he'd
seen what was...
Right, he'd seen what was going. And when I was told that he said that, I felt such validation because it was an observer who'd seen, you know, what I had been living through. So in the talk, I go into how, you know, this was the situation with gaslighting. But then at the end, I said there were three options. There was writing a book.
Right.
So that was the third option.
Right.
Suicide, murder, or creative expression.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's, I think, what saved me and what saves all of us who have such anger and turmoil that we live with from our childhood. It's being able to express yourself and tell your story that gets you through it.
And also is a tremendous help to others.
I think so, because
absolutely,
it makes people feel less alone.
Right. People suffer with this shit and they don't know what to do with it. And, you know, they don't know how to identify it and they don't know, you know, that this might be why they're having the problems they're having. And sometimes it's a key, a window in, a door.
Right.
Yeah. Well, what kind of response are you getting to the book?
People, it's been very gratifying because a lot of people have said that, I shouldn't be, but I'm surprised how many people have pernicious relationships with their parents, you know, and a lot of people do. A lot of people go through it. And the response has been great because they tell me it's helped them a lot and it's made them feel less alone.
Yeah.
And they always say, oh, my story wasn't as bad as yours.
Right.
Just kind of like, I don't know. I was like, is that a good thing? Is that a compliment? I don't know. But I feel it's I'm still in the aftermath of it. I feel like I did what I had to do, and now I don't know what else is as important.
Yeah.
You know, like, what do I, where am I going next?
But, well, how does she react to it? Now, you don't really identify her in the book, so that's why I'm not pressing you for a name, but what's her reaction to it? Have you gleaned anything? Have you heard? Have you?
Oh, yeah. Her reaction was very upset at first, and then very apologetic, and then very remorseful, and then very angry. And then, you know, it was as unpredictable as I predicted.
Did she make it about her?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, but I think
it was about her, so.
Yes, and on a deep level, she knows.
Uh-huh.
You know, a level that she can't really talk about or access in a way that is useful to us.
Yeah.
But she knows.
Yeah.
You know.
Ugh.
And she had it too. You know, she had a horrible, horrible life. And
she
never got over it.
Yeah.
And she had a wonderful life and a horrible, you know, it's always.
Yeah. I just like, sometimes it's weird.
Never one thing.
Like the pain of moving through stuff and whatever relief you get, or whatever clarity you get of acknowledging and sort of dealing with the wound or the trauma, like you, something stays the same. Do you know what I mean?
What do you mean?
Well, like I know a lot about myself, and I know a lot of people go through things, but a lot of times you open all this stuff up and there's a relief to it. But like, you know, once you really identify and own yourself, you know, especially at the age that I'm at or you're at, you know, you really get this moment where you're like, okay, so what do I want to do with my life?
Right. Totally. Totally. Like,
okay, that's done. I figured that out. So now let's start living.
Right. It's such a part of your identity.
Right. I guess that's
And then it's an identity crisis.
Yeah. Whereas then you get people who just sort of, you know, stiff upper lip, or, you know, just kind of like get on with it, and they just live locked in that pattern without the investigation. There's moments where I'm like, I don't know if that's terrible. You know what I mean?
Well, some people are disabled. I mean,
emotionally disabled. Yes. And I guess the real problem with that, and like something I see, you know, my brother struggling with, is that on some level, the responsibility, if you are able to have empathy or be a little bit of selflessness, is that, you know, you can, your responsibility is to stop the cycle, in the sense that, you know, if you do the work and you do the vulnerability and open yourself up at the risk of that, you know, once you do get to a place where you have some peace with it, that, you know, hopefully you don't treat people the same way, or your children, or whatever the fuck it is.
And you think of other people.
Right.
That's a big one.
Empathy was very hard for me. Mm. Like, I had it, but, you know, it was inverted in some weird way. You know, that wasn't like, you know, like acknowledging separateness as much as it was like, oh man, I just thought about how you probably feel and I feel terrible.
Right.
Like, there's no, like,
you have to work at that.
Right. I can't hold the space and let you have your feelings. I can take them.
Right.
Yeah. You know, sponge them up and then make it about me.
Right.
But, you know, I can't give you your space, but doing this podcast really, you know, helped me with that. It made me do it.
It made you have empathy.
Well, it made me connect with it. Like, I think it was there, but it was not quite right. You know, the ability to, and I still, you know, talk over people, or I'm quick to sort of absorb what they're feeling, and, you know, and then, you know, make it about me. You know, like, I do that. But I'm much more aware of, like, you know, like, just don't say anything.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay.
Mm-hmm.
You can just, all you gotta do is be present for this.
Right.
And that's enough.
Right.
You don't, you're not gonna fix nothing here. You're not gonna, you know, it's not your, you know, this isn't your life, and they've been living it. So you don't have to, there's no advice that has to be here. You just have to hold the space and bear witness.
Right, right.
And that's helpful.
And sometimes to say, oh, that must be really hard.
Yeah, oh yeah, yeah. Oh yeah, that's horrible. Yeah, I get choked up, but now it's for the right reasons, you know.
Right.
Not because, like, God, if I went through that.
Or, like, how do I prepare for that not happening to me?
Yeah, yeah. I don't do that. That doesn't really happen.
Right. But do you have, so this is that's a bigger one, but forgiveness with your parents?
Sometimes. I don't know how. More than I used to. You know, like, because I had to do, like, at some point I had to see them as people without expectations and without the idea that they were going to show up for what they didn't or that they were going to change. But just to really have that moment where you're like, yeah, that's who that person is.
Right.
And I can accept that.
Right.
I guess that's sort of forgiveness. In terms of how they treated me or what I became, I did all right. You know, I am emotionally crippled in some way, you know, but there's a lot worse.
To me, it's very, I've been thinking about that a lot because people say, you know, do you forgive her and, you know,
yeah,
all of this. And I think compassion is really different than forgiveness, mm-hmm, right? Like I have compassion now.
Yeah.
I've moved through that anger.
Yeah.
I have compassion.
Mm-hmm.
But forgiveness is different because it's opening a door that allows people, I think, to continue to hurt you to a certain extent, you know, and people,
right. And it's trickier.
Yeah, it's trickier. So.
Well, I mean, but you can, it's like forgiving somebody after they're dead or something, like, you know, you can do then. I mean, like, forgiveness does not have to be
right.
Interactive, right?
No, that's true. You can forgive someone without having to have to be engaging with them.
Yeah. We'll work on it.
All right.
Thanks for coming.
Okay. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. So that was heavy. Was it heavy or was it helpful? Sometimes I don't know. Sometimes they're one and the same, aren't they? Okay. All right. Okay. All right. I need to meditate. Let's play some meditative guitar. A little bit of meditative guitar. Let's go back to the electric. Hey folks, this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. You know all those times you've heard guests sneeze on the show? Well, actually, you don't hear any of that because we cut the sneezes out when we're editing. But take my word for it, people definitely sneeze in here. And when they do, I've got a box of Kleenex on the table right in front of them so they can use one and get right back to business. And here's what Kleenex means to me: a tissue that will hold up. We've all used those other tissues that you blow holes right through. When I see Kleenex, I know that tissue is up for the job. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.